Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 56, recorded June 6th, 2012. Andrew Keen. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click the radio microphone, and use the offer code TRIANGULATION. And by GoToAssist. With GoToAssist from Citrix, you can take control of your IT world from one simple cloud-based platform. Provide live or unattended support to all your users anywhere. For a free 30-day trial, visit GoToAssist.com and use the promo code TRIANGULATION. It's time for Triangulation, the show where Tom Merritt and I look for a fifth leg to the stool. Did you see that?
Fifth leg?
That's what Tim Cook said, that the Apple TV was not the fifth leg of the stool. And I thought, what kind of stools does he sit on anyway?
Four-legged stools,
I guess. So, apparently.
Yeah.
Tom Merritt, host of TNT, and he's dressed for the occasion. Oh, you have a date?
I had to go to court.
Oh, good.
All
right.
I don't know why. I just threw it on.
No, you know what? I like it, and I think we should all do this. And, Sarah, I want you to wear a tie, too. I think we're all going to wear ties from now on, and we're going to make our guests wear ties. How about that?
I don't think Andrew will go for it.
Andrew Keen is our guest. We talked to Andrew when The Cult of the Amateur came out, which was his previous book. But, you know, I didn't know this about you. You're also an entrepreneur. You started Audio Cafe.
Yes.
Back in 95.
Yeah.
And now you've become probably the best known anti-internet spokesperson, right? The new book is called Digital Vertigo. I could just give you the subtitle, you get it. How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us.
But do you like being called anti-internet? Because you use the internet to great effect.
Well, look at what he does for his author's byline, at AJ Keen. His Twitter handle.
I don't think you're against the internet.
No, I don't think I'm against it. I mean, I'm using it all the time. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm on it all the time. And I think this book is a little bit more forgiving of the internet than my first book, which was...
Would you retract what you... The first book, The Cult of the Amateur, was basically, the premise was, here come the losers, the people who can't make content, and watch out, and we're going to... Do you think that that's still true? That's still the case?
Well, I think the book has actually aged pretty well. When the book came out, it was almost universally condemned, particularly by your audience, I'm sure. They probably burnt it. And I think, looking back, I don't think... We're still struggling to figure out business models. The crisis of journalism, of the music industry...
That hasn't gone away.
Hasn't gone away. Yeah. You know, so I'm all in favor of Spotify, but it doesn't seem as if they're really supporting... enabling the support of a viable income for musicians.
Right.
The journalism is just as much in crisis as any time, and piracy hasn't really gone away. So I think a lot of the things... Everyone has always assumed that a business model would emerge. I've heard it for 15
years. We still
assume
that for Facebook, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's all going to make sense. Just buy it. And
yeah, the eyeballs eventually, or traffic, or...
Right.
Audience will eventually result in income. It does for Facebook and Google, but it doesn't necessarily for the artist. I mean, I wasn't, in Cult of the Amateur, I wasn't questioning the internet economy. I was questioning the impact of the internet economy on the creative class, on writers, musicians, filmmakers, as a consequence of two things. Firstly, the free economy, and secondly, piracy. And I think those things are...
Those are still a problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a big issue.
What is the evidence that piracy is causing a problem? That's what I get hung up with. And I'm not saying that I don't believe it, but we see it. We tend to sort of jump right into, like, well, piracy is a problem, so let's do SOPA, or let's do this or that. Where can we get good data that says, here's the effect it's having?
Well, you can get it from the music industry. You can get it from the motion picture industry.
Can we? I haven't seen any.
Well, talk to my friends at the RIAA or the MPAA. I mean, there's clearly two issues. To get hard, exact numbers, I think is impossible. But I think it would be also hard to argue that it's not having an impact. I think it would be hard to argue that you've had two things going on simultaneously with the music industry. You had, I think, a 50% drop in sales of music, and you had the internet, and you had Napster, and you had Kazaa, and all these other networks that enabled the, basically, anyone could get any music for free without having to pay for it with at very low risk. So there's clearly a connection. But on the other hand, the music industry now...
You could kind of blame their intransigence.
Oh, however. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, I'm not going to defend the music or the... I mean, their intransigence, their arrogance, it's clearly they have a role to play. But I also think the argument that, well, we don't have any direct proof that we don't have the exact numbers, therefore it's not a problem, is also a bad argument.
Well, I think the other side of the argument is, well, it's just common sense. Piracy must cost. And, you know, I mean, I think there are a number of people who've said, well, I can prove that giving away my stuff has actually sold more stuff, and that handled properly, this is, I think, the issue, is handled properly, it's an opportunity.
I think it works for people who already have brands.
I disagree. Jonathan Coulton didn't have a brand. He was able to use the internet to create a career. I think Cory Doctorow has shown that. Paul Coelho.
Paul Coelho
did not have a brand. Right. The internet gave him a brand.
Well, but Cory Doctorow already had a brand.
And maybe Cory did. Paul Coelho.
Coelho. Yeah, but I still think that...
In fact, he used piracy to his advantage.
But for most artists, it's still hard to give your stuff away.
Right.
I mean, it's still...
You know what? It's always been hard for artists. And I support artists, and I agree. Anything that we could do to make it easier to be a creator and make a living is a good thing.
What troubles me, I think, is amongst some of the pro-SOPA crowd is just this undying hostility towards big media, which I think is bad.
There is an anti-corporatism.
Yeah, an this idea that Hollywood's bad, the labels are bad, the publishers are bad. I'm under no illusion that these are perfect organizations or perfect people. But they have enabled, you know, 50 years of high-quality movies and books and music. It doesn't mean that all the music and movies and books that have been produced are high quality, but some of them are. And they have enabled a lot of creative people to make a good living. And there doesn't seem to be, it's not as if there's an alternative economy emerging.
I think there is, though. I think we're engaged in a great experiment, which may have a downside.
Mm.
It is a great experiment, but I think the great experiment of democratizing media gives many people a voice, and I think there's going to be a...
Well, I think you, for example, are a perfect example. But really, when it comes down to it, how different are you from television? You're just a high-quality broadcaster who has emerged.
That's probably my failing, because I come from that era. Yeah. I mean, I think when your kids and my kids start creating, they will be natives of this new medium, and perhaps we'll use it in a different way. Those of us who are old-timers just use it the way we knew. I mean, this is what I know, so this is what I do.
But do you think that this operation that we have here could exist without the openness of the internet? The ability to just
turn on the camera. We tried it. It was called Tech TV, and it didn't. It failed.
No, but my book, Call to the Amateur, would never have been critical of this. I would have actually... I didn't in my solutions chapter, because you hadn't really had this fancy studio, but if I was rewriting Call to the Amateur, I would include you as a paragon of what can go right. I would say, here's the future.
Right. So what is
I'll
there
take to...
Because I think you're right. We have battling overreactions. On the one hand, you have Hollywood saying, you're all a bunch of thieves and idiots, and you got to stop it. And then you have the people saying, oh, well, you're over-influential, and you just want to, you know, rake us over the coals and take all our money. And the truth is somewhere in the middle there.
Right.
But what is the danger of the internet? I mean, again, you know, that's Cult of the Amateur talking, but digital vertigo, how today's online social revolution is dividing. What is the danger?
I think what I've learned most of all between the two books is that it's wrong to see technology and the internet as the thing in itself, as the thing that causes everything else.
Hmm.
So I think in Cult of the Amateur, I made the argument that culture was being killed by the internet. And there was a sexy subtitle, and it sold very well, and it built my name, and I'm not disowning that.
I got angry at you just overhearing you at CNET.
You did?
You're giving an interview. I was like, what is the guy talking about? Good.
Well, you see, I had an impact.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the reality about the internet, I did a debate last night with, what's his name, the guy up in Marin.
Tim O'Reilly?
No, he would never talk to me. he's not up, you know, he's in Sebastopol.
Yeah.
You know, a Grateful Dead lyricist.
Oh, John Perry Barlow, yeah.
And he and I, oddly enough, were in agreement about a lot of things. And he said, look, the internet is just a mirror.
That's right.
And I think he's right. So that's why also, it's why it's so interesting, but it's also why we're so sensitive about it. Because when someone like me comes along and criticizes it, a lot of people take it simply as criticism of them.
Of them.
Which I guess in a sense it is. But for the first time, and I think he said it last night, we did an Economist debate, we have an opportunity to look at ourselves. It's a mirror. And we're incredibly sensitive, but it's a very accurate, a very honest picture. And of course, it can be idealized by guys like Jeff Jarvis and Clay Shirky, but it also can be critiqued by people like myself, Nick Carr, Sherry Turkle. So there's clearly an interesting debate emerging, but I am not someone, I think I've moved, even in spite of even this subtitle, I've moved away, and I think the book reflects that, I've moved away from the idea that the internet is the first mover. I see technology as much as a consequence, as a cause.
And yet, the medium can be the message. And in this case, I think there is a message that the medium brings us. It's not a purely impartial medium.
Well, we're not impartial.
Yeah. Maybe so. It's just reflecting our...
But I am, and I think what ties the two books together is this idea that technology can somehow liberate us.
Right.
And that technology can make us better.
Yeah, we're technology idealists here.
So. You are?
Yeah,
you're
of course.
Not really.
Sure.
So do you think that technology can bring out the best in us?
Absolutely.
It can, yes.
But it can also bring out the worst.
Yeah, exactly.
It does both.
You can stab somebody in the neck with a screwdriver, or you can build shelves.
And I've always thought technology is agnostic. Yeah. There are some technologies that have clearly a positive or negative. You know, MRIs are mostly positive, and nuclear weapons are mostly negative. But I think the internet and the digital technology... does have a slant towards the beneficial only because it's a very powerful lever. Now, of course, any lever can be used for good or ill. And this comes from my kind of foundational belief that humans are fundamentally good. So if it's a lever for humanity,
it will be... reading too much Rousseau.
I think so. I do believe in the perfectibility of man. I think that in the long run, it will be a lever for the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly there'll be negatives. But anything that... I'm a believer in democracy. Anything that democratizes, gives people a voice. Yes, there'll be a lot of Nazi propaganda or whatever, you know, negative voices, but they will be drowned out in the long run by the positive voices. That's my belief. But it's purely a belief. I don't think there's any empirical evidence of the perfectibility of man.
You just said that publicly. Why don't you repeat that for your audience? You'll become the Antichrist.
Would you want
it all.
When you talk about that mirror, I think that's exactly what the internet is. It's a tool also, but I think we see humanity in a way we've never had a chance to see it before.
Yeah, I agree.
And I like what you're saying, actually. I think it's a good point about digital narcissism.
Because what this book is about.
Not everyone is a narcissist. But the internet makes it a lot easier to indulge in that.
I love the opening pages of this. You talk about visiting the first true narcissist, Jeremy Bentham, who was a 19th century industrialist who somehow persuaded, where is it, Cambridge? Where is he?
University College London.
London, to put taxidermy stat? He's there. His coffin is there in a glass case. You can walk by and you see him.
He left it for the benefit of mankind.
That was very good of him.
I think it's a very appropriate metaphor for what social media is all about. We are all Jeremy Benthams in our own little... What do you call himself? The icon?
He built this thing called the auto icon.
Auto icon.
But what's interesting about Bentham is why he's... sort of he forms part of the narrative in Digital Vertigo, is not only did he invent the auto icon, but he also invented something called the panopticon,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which was the all-seeing prison or school, which was used by enlightened despots like Catherine the Great in Russia to control their population. Mm-hmm. And what I fear, and the architecture of social media as it evolves, is that we're creating... A sort of a willing panopticon, what he called an inspection house, a place where we're being seen all the time by everyone, It's different from Bentham's panopticon in the sense there isn't a single person, a big brother in the middle of it. But it is a similar kind of architecture. Bentham described his panopticon as a simple idea of architecture. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, my God, it's identical to what the Internet is, which is, of course, also...
It's just architecture.
Yeah, all it is architecture.
Why isn't it more like the village? Because we lacked a lot of privacy in a small village. And that's usually the other side of this. It's like, well, no, the Internet's a global village, and we're going back to that lack of privacy.
Well, that's the core argument. So I think that's where we make our choice. I agree. I mean, a lot of people have said the Internet goes back to the village and that the privacy that we have built over the last 200 years is an aberration.
Zuckerberg, it's an accidental
privacy. So Zuckerberg talks about the Internet being a well-lit door, Facebook being a well-lit dorm room. Jeff Jarvis in Public Parts talks about, he idealizes Thomas More's utopia as a place where everybody was able to live together. And, of course, the village is reappearing. McLuhan talked about the global village. Now, I personally don't want that. I have never lived in a village, and I don't want to live in a village.
You like the city, the anonymity of the city.
It's ironic. In my first book, I criticized anonymity, and there's only one thing worse than anonymity, and that's a lack of anonymity. But I don't want to live in a city. If I'm nostalgic for anything, it's the anonymity of the city. So what I fear is that we are literally creating this village. And, you know, Leah, we can go backwards and forwards on whether the Internet makes us better or worse people. But I think I don't want to live in a village. It's parochial. It's intolerant. Much, you know, you can read the Scarlet Letter. I mean, if you want to go back into American
history.
But
this is the opposite. Doesn't this make us less intolerant because we get to see other people and how other people live and realize that they're just people? And
well, that's the core debate. So I could sit here and in my book I talk about the lack of generosity which exists in much of social media. David Weinberger, you, Jeff Jarvis, Weinberger actually says that it makes us more generous.
Yeah.
So you're listening.
Look at Kickstarter. Look at Kiva.
But, you know, you can point to those and I can point to lots of examples of intolerance, racism, the example of the poor kid who jumped out of his dorm room because he was exposed as being gay.
Right.
I think the jury is out. I think we could sit here all afternoon and go backwards and forwards on this. I don't think it's clear.
I agree.
And I think that's the problem with assuming that technology makes us better. Technology just amplifies us.
Right.
We become human on steroids in a way.
Right.
But it doesn't make us... I think I have sometimes erred in arguing that technology makes us worse. But I still would not agree that technology makes us better.
So how do we learn how to use technology to make us better?
Let's get to the practical in a moment.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
First, we're going to learn how technology helps us do our mail.
Our stamps.
Our stamps. Our guest is Andrew Keene, AJ Keene, on Twitter, at AJ Keene, AJKeene.com. And the newest book, which just came out, I mean, it's literally a couple of weeks old. Still smells good. Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. See, there is some value to paper. Kindles, they need a little Kindle spray that you spray on your Kindle that makes it smell like that.
It's like that USB thing that would, like, give you coffee smell when you visit it.
Yeah. Let me tell you, this is one thing Stamps.com has not perfected, is how to get the odor of the post office into your home or office.
You don't get the taste of stamps.
You don't get that. Well, yeah, you don't even have to lick the stamp. Yeah, you know, that's not
such a bad thing.
Maybe I shouldn't do this ad. I mean, don't you want to lick stamps? Don't you want to go to the post office and just kind of hang? Maybe not. Stamps.com lets you bring the post office to your desk because basically you've got all the postage you could ever want. You print your own U.S. postage using your own computer, your own printer. This is not a postage meter. You don't need one of those. People are still renting postage meters. You don't need special ink. You just need your existing computer, your existing printer, and stamps.com. It's great if you're an Amazon or eBay seller because they'll fill out the forms for you. International mail. I bet Andrew's sending stuff back to the UK all the time. And you know it's a pain when you want to do that. You got to go to the post office, get the special international postage thing, fill out the... This does it all for you, completely. In fact, you even get a scale that you put this thing on, and it gives you exactly the right postage. It's a USB scale. All of this is yours free right now. If you go to stamps.com And now here's the deal. You see on the front there, it says $80 no risk trial. Don't do that. There's a microphone up in the right-hand corner. Click that. Oh, see, secret. And enter triangulation. That's a long word. We should really have a shorter name for that. Triangulation. Watch what happens to that $80 offer. It's now $110. You get $55 in postage coupons. $55 in free postage. You get a digital scale. You just pay the shipping and handling, a $5 supply kit, 4-week trial at no cost to you. This is a really nice deal. I want you to try it because I'll tell you, when you get to the end of that month, you're going to say, this was great. I haven't been to the post office. I haven't had to worry about that. The mail carrier comes and picks up your packages of any size. It's very professional looking, too. You print right on the envelope if you want. You know, you could still lick the envelope.
Sure, yeah, if you need to lick something.
I'll talk to Stamps.com, and it'd be interesting if they get like a little spray, a little post office spray. They just a little... You go.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Is going to the post office the most miserable experience?
Do you go to the post office a lot?
Well, I'm just thinking I'm going to buy one of these because, and I'm not even being paid by Stamps.com, because I think going to the post office represents the most miserable experience of the analog industrial age.
I wasn't going to say. No, there is a worse experience.
What?
DMV. And if we ever get DMV.com, yeah. I will give them free ads. But no, it isn't fun.
It's
now,
terrible.
They've asked us not to focus on how awful it is, because, frankly, the post office is a little sensitive, but they're closing post offices. Can you find a letterbox anymore, a mailbox? They're gone. They took them out. Did you notice that when that happened? I noticed you cannot go find a corner with the mail. What, you have one?
Yeah, there's one right up there.
You know what else they've got rid of? I was in London last week.
That's an old neighborhood.
You know what else they've got rid of, which is sadder, is telephone boxes.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
But they're not full of urine.
Well, where do people pee in London anymore, after all?
Policeman's call box.
But no, you're lucky, but you know, watch that mailbox like a hawk, because it's going to be gone.
First neighborhood I've lived in.
It's going to be gone. We had them all over here, and they put one day, there was a sign, and it said, "This we're taking it out. Go to the post office." I'm not kidding. And, you know,
I think Eichler put it
when they came and got the Jews, I just sat and watched. No, it's probably going
that's horrible.
On. That's Godwin's law right there. I've done it again. Stamps.com is now disavowing any knowledge.
They came from my blue post office box.
They came for the box. Did I say anything? No.
Yeah, actually.
I was complacent.
You were complaining just now.
I did. I complained.
But, on the other hand, Leo, and this comes back to the amateur argument.
Yes.
Who is going to employ all those people who walk around? I mean, how many people work for Stamps.com?
Are you making an argument that we should keep this system because it employs people whose only skill is walking around?
It's a very noble skill, and it ties.
No, I love the mail carrier.
They're all going to make money.
Did you hear what I said? The mail carrier comes and they get the package from you, so they have a job. It's not somebody still has to deliver it. It's not like they don't deliver it. I'm not saying get rid of delivery. I'm saying that you can print the postage and then they come and get it. So the walkers still have a job.
Oh, good.
All right, I promise.
And a healthier job than standing behind a desk.
Stamps.com. Try it right now. Promo code triangulation. It does raise an interesting issue. Do we have some sort of obligation? To not use these technologies because it will inconvenience people or the music industry or
we don't,
mail carriers?
We don't, but on the other hand, I think I had dinner last night after the Economist event with Andy McAfee, who's at MIT. I don't know if you know him.
I don't.
He and another economist there called Eric Bjolson came out with a small pamphlet on the Kindle a few months ago showing that the impact of technology was creating massive unemployment. Now, he's not a curmudgeon like me. He's not a hardcore reactionary, but he's recognizing the numbers. They're going to write that. You should get these guys on your show, actually.
We should. We will. But this is not news. I mean, Jeremy Rifkin wrote The End of Work 20 years ago was going to happen.
But what their point is that
pre-internet,
economists have always assumed that technology will create unemployment, but it will also generate new jobs.
Right.
The problem today is that where's the evidence?
Right. There are no new jobs.
You know, look at Facebook. I mean, for a $60-70 billion company, how many people does it employ?
2,000, yeah.
Or Boxy. I mean, it's even worse.
Well, this
but
is an example.
You could argue that it's the recession that's causing the lack of jobs right now. So is the data reliable?
Yeah, but where are these new jobs going to be created? I mean, where do we create these jobs? Is it at the chip fabs? Is it people working in internet startups? I don't know.
Maybe it's people doing things on Kickstarter.
I do kind of despair for our children's generation. In fact, one of the things that I have really been promoting is that they be taught entrepreneurialism, that they need to create their own jobs.
Oh, absolutely.
But you know, our kids are kind of
They're not really typical.
They're not typical. And I worry about a whole generation of underemployed people with, what is unemployment now, 8.73? It's high.
In Spain, it's 50% unemployment of kids.
But is that because of technology or is that because of the banking crisis?
Well, it's certainly not because of technology only in Spain. But there is a connection, I think, between this sort of long... The reality of struggling to bring unemployment down in America is also bound up in tech, which is...
But Andrew, what do you do? You can't turn back the clock.
No, you can't
cannot
turn
put
back.
The genie back in the bottle.
And we may be going into a sort of break... I mean, Eric and Andy says that... That robots will be able to generate enough wealth that we'll all be able to live quite well. We're not going to starve.
This is the argument in the industrial era.
New world where we're on shows like this, or we're watching TV, or what are we doing?
It's Wall-E. We're all sitting.
We're all creating. I mean,
some of us better than others. Though.
Sure, absolutely. And that's why
it's good that we have amateurs, because we're all going to be creators, even if you suck. It doesn't matter because there's plenty of leisure and plenty to go around.
And you won't even need to make a living because you're going to be waited on by your robot.
Right. The surplus will take care of it.
It's the Star Trek Next Generation theory. We eliminate money. Everything is available.
It does kind of come down to, but kind of people's worldview, whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, whether you believe in the perfectibility of man or the innate evil. Does it really come down to that in the end? Are you a negative person, Andrew?
I'm very negative. You know me. I'm cheerfully pessimistic. My background really, most of all, even though I've done a lot of different things, is as a historian. And I've just seen and read about too many periods in history where we believed in what Leo calls the perfectibility of man. And it's always gone so seriously wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm a little skeptical of it.
History's on your side.
Yeah.
Well, yes, we always do get it wrong, but then we end up figuring out why we got it wrong.
Right.
And we do tend to improve over the long term.
There has been progress, hasn't there? I mean...
There has been, but in my book, it's quite a historical book. I say, look, we're not...
It is wonderful that way, by the way. I really enjoy... You know, I mean, there's a big bibliography, and there's a lot of
people will learn something even if they don't agree.
There is a lot of scholarliness,
but it's not dense.
No, it's very entertaining. But I love how you bring in things like the Chartist demonstrations of April 1848.
But the key sort of argument in the book is that we're going through something which is structurally dramatic, equivalent to the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely.
And everything's changing.
Absolutely.
Everything's up for grabs. All the old assumptions are being broken down. Now, my argument is what I fear most is the challenge to the autonomy and privacy of the individual. But coming back, Tom, to your question about how good or bad can it be, we can look back at the Industrial Revolution and you can make either argument. You could make the argument the Industrial Revolution resulted in communism and fascism and death camps, which it did, but also the Industrial Revolution resulted in the city, in individual rights, in parliamentary democracy. So I think we have to understand the magnitude of the change, that both options, they may even coexist. I mean, it's not as if it's either going to be really bad or really good. It's going to be a mixture of the two. But I think we have to understand the magnitude of the change. And that's how, you know, I would agree with people like Jeff Jarvis and Clay Shirky and all the other guys that this is a massive change. This is not cosmetic. This is changing everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if my personal theory is that when you're going through some massive change like this, humanity in the past has gone through lots of undulations. Horrible things happen, good things happen. No one has an idea of where it's going to end up, but it does, in the long term, pay off. We have been able to continue to, at least, you know, with exceptions like the fall of the Roman Empire and the Black Death, we've eventually improved. Would you agree with that?
I would say it comes down, again, Leo was talking about whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist. It may also come down to our understanding of history. There are two schools of thought in history. One, and it tends to be an American view, that sees history in terms of progress, of this upward ascent to toleration and wealth and freedom. And others who are more cyclical, who don't see history in terms of progress. So that's another age-old debate. What's really great about the internet, actually, is that all these classic conversations about freedom and progress and the perfectibility of man, they've all happened before. And I think one of the purposes of my book is to explain to people, look, in some ways, social media is new and the internet's new and all that's new.
Yeah.
But the arguments we're having aren't new. They've been done before, and we can actually learn a lot from the past. So I work off the debate between Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. I'm a big follower of Mill and his book on liberty, which is this major defense of individual autonomy and innovation in the mass age of the Industrial Revolution. And I fear we're in a similar age in terms of the autonomy and privacy of the individual in the social digital age.
You say, so what to do? How can we make sure our lives don't become versions of the Scoble show? And we become voyeuristic inmates of a luxury prison, entirely disconnected from our neighbors, yet possessing tens of thousands of friends that we have never and will never meet. How can we guarantee our right to privacy and secrecy? This is a debate that we have all the time here, even in today's age of exhibitionism, so that today's creepy doesn't become tomorrow's necessity. So what
even
is
you guys are, you've got to be a bit wary.
We constantly
of Facebook,
talk about it. Yes.
Absolutely. I don't use Facebook.
Oh, you don't? So
no.
You're resistant.
I mean, I have an account because I want to keep familiar with how it works.
So he's another reaction.
Yeah.
I killed my Facebook account last
you
year.
Did?
And I brought it back because I can't do this job without Facebook.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I actually enjoy it now.
You do?
I do enjoy it. I like the conversation. I like the interaction.
You're not bothered about being turned into a product?
Well, that'd be kind of hypocritical of me, wouldn't it?
Why?
I think I am a product. Well, but I'm not a typical person.
I think it's okay to be a product if you know what you're being asked.
Yeah.
And you're willing to say, yes, I will give you this information.
I chose a long time ago to be a product.
Yeah.
That's my business. But and I live in public also. That's, well,
but not really.
Not really. Nobody lives fully in public.
Well, except Scoble.
Wow. Even Scoble, I think. There, I suspect there are
science has not yet
there
determined
are deeper, deeper there layers there. But do you have a prescription? I mean, do you have?
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book. I think I have. I don't think there's a single magic bullet. I think the first thing is I want everyone to really think about whether they. No, I don't want to pick on Scoble. He's a friend, and I tease him in the book, but it's not.
He's
really
fun to tease. We all.
He's
love
a lovely
him.
Guy.
Yeah.
But we have to think: do we really want to destroy our privacy? Do we want to live in public? Do we want to be these sandwich board men in the digital age, where everywhere we go, everyone knows everything about us: where we work, where we cycle to, where we drive, what we listen to, what we're reading, what we have done, what we will do? I think Brandeis and Warren wrote their famous defense of privacy in the 19th century. These two Harvard Law School academics, and they said, when everything is known about you, it does away with the core mystery of the formation of personality. And I think that that's what privacy is. It maintains our uniqueness.
Are you arguing for the choice?
Well,
are you saying don't do it?
Well, I'm saying that it's not for me to tell people whether they should or shouldn't be on Facebook or how many hours a day they're on Twitter. But I would like people to think about how far they want to go. And I want to think about the legacy they want to leave to their kids and to next generation. So that's the first thing. I mean, it's just a book designed to get people to think about the new world, the new architecture. And I have a high view of it. So I'm putting all the pieces together. It's not just a critique of Facebook, but it's a critique of this Web 3.0, big data, like economy.
That's what Reid Hoffman calls it, Web 3.
And the book is also built off a debate I did about with Reid Hoffman at Oxford about whether social media are the new nation states. So that's the first thing. It's a message to people to think. The second, I think, is we need some legislation.
Now you're scaring me.
Now the libertarians are going to have a struggle.
Yeah, you're scaring me. Well, only because government has shown itself completely ham-fisted with regard to technology.
But then are you suggesting that government never has a role? I think
it's a lack of confidence that they can carry off the role properly.
Well, that's the government to get their act together. Maybe
maybe
in Europe they're a little bit more together. I'm sympathetic, for example, to Vivian Redding's idea
of right
giving people the right to forget.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Although it's technologically infeasible.
Well, is it?
Yeah.
Infeasible?
Yes. I hate to say it. But that's, I mean,
at
that's to me, an ex- well, I think that's an example of a political will that is not reflected by a technological.
What about do not track legislation?
Now we can get in a long debate on that.
But
because I have a strong opinion that that is a a red herring. I don't think tracking is the issue at all. In fact, tracking is a misnomer for what's actually going on.
Okay, well, encouraging, and I don't want to use the word forcing, but governments getting involved to push technology companies to tell their users much more about how they are and not using
data. I think it's
data.
Fine to legislate for choice, to legislate for opt-in, for instance. I think the government never stops at that point. What government wants to do is regulate. And the unintended consequences of regulating something that you don't in the first place understand, in fact, that even those of us who spend a lot of time, and I include the three of us here, thinking about it, dimly understand, these people, they are Luddites in many cases, yeah. And they're making regulations that they don't, of stuff they don't understand. SOPA was a perfect example, and then have unintended consequences that are often completely the opposite of what they intended.
I think legislation can be used as a substitute for education in some cases. In other words, what would be perfect is if everyone was smart enough to understand, oh, when I do this on the internet, these are the implications of it. And we say, well, not everybody's going to understand that, so let's put in legislation to stop that. Well, I'm not saying I'm entirely against legislation, but I think we have some other things to do first.
I'm absolutely with John Perry Barlow on this. Hands off the internet.
This is my... I would respond to you, Leo, that you can't use the SOPA argument always. I mean, I acknowledge the
fact... Well, it's just the most proximate argument. I think we can go back in time.
Yeah, but just because government comes up with bad legislation doesn't mean that all government legislation is bad.
Sure.
And you're right. Government is slow. There's a problem in this country.
Can't keep up.
It doesn't attract quality people. Right. So I'd rather, you know, next generation Reid Hoffman needs to go into government. A Biz Stone, a Mark Zuckerberg. Let's figure out a way
deal.
To get our smartest people into government.
Deal. And this is what Larry Lessig has decided. Larry Lessig initially...
Well, he's not necessarily one of the smartest people there, is he?
Larry? Yeah. You don't like Larry?
He's not my best friend.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, what about his?
What
I think
about
he's
his
very
purpose?
Smart.
His purpose is let's reform government.
Well, exactly. Right. He realized that the underlying problem to copyright, which he was fighting the good fight on, was, wait a minute, I can't solve this problem until we solve the campaign finance issue, until we can have a non-corrupt government.
But we also have a problem in America that there's just a deep hostility to politics, to politicians.
Well, that's a shame, because government is us, after all.
Yeah,
right?
so I would accept your argument that, you know, it shouldn't be over-regulated, but I'm not a libertarian. I think there's a need for some legislation. And then I think the real opportunity is with the market. I mean, I'm really excited what Microsoft are doing with IE10.
Oh, see, that's, to me, such a... This is, you're talking about they're going to turn do not track on by default.
Yes. EveryMe, DuckDuckGo, all these new companies that are making... What's horrible about that?
So horrible.
Why?
Because it completely misunderstands... First of all, the word tracking is so loaded, and it's not what's happening. In fact, we were just talking about this on Twig. There was just an article today from one of the database companies saying, we don't want people's names. We don't want people's individual identities. That's noise to us. We just want to match. And I think this is what people want. We want to match the ads to your interests.
But I don't
That's
be,
tracking.
No, I don't want to be followed.
It's not following. That's the idea. See, this is why tracking is such a loaded and bad choice of words.
But isn't opt-in always the best?
I would argue that it's fine to have opt-in. However, I think that what there is an unintended consequence to do not track. Do not track is based on this notion that there is a human being who is literally stalking you. And that's not what this technology does. This technology is merely trying to make sure you don't see the same ad more than three times, that you see ads that are things that you're interested in. It's not personal. It isn't. They're not after A.J. Keene or Tom Merritt or Leo Laporte. In fact, that information is they don't want. And the problem is that by Microsoft turning this switch on, they're undermining an entire internet economy that is based on the notion of ads that are aimed at you. And
well,
I think people
because they're aimed websites at you.
Well, they do a terrible idea. The truth is they do a terrible job. And there's no evidence that tracking ads, in fact, work at all. We don't do, for instance, what we do is ads that are targeted, not tracked. And they do work. There's a lot of evidence that Google ads and Facebook ads, in fact, are horrible. Facebook is presumably tracking you and knows more about you than anybody else, and they offer you ads that are completely useless.
But it's not an effective technology. I don't like the experience of going to a website and then everywhere I go on the internet having that website fed back to me in an advertisement. I like the idea. I'm not sure if I'll use IE10. I'm a Firefox user, but I like the idea of Do Not Track being default. And then if I want to change it, fine. But it's much better
than
the other.
Well, no, but first of all, no one will ever change it.
Well, then, but then you reverse it, and that's the reality.
No one will ever change that.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's the reality as it is now, by the way.
But what do you think of these new wave of privacy-centric companies? Have you looked at EveryMe, DuckDuckGo, Reputation.com? That's where I think the market will really be exciting, because I think there's a real demand. I wrote a piece.
I think they're playing on people's fears, and they're actually not doing anything of significant importance.
I'm not sure it's sustainable.
It's FUD.
Because I think there is a lot of FUD out there about privacy. And we may get to the point where
they have enough. So you don't buy that there's a problem with privacy?
No, I buy that there's a problem, but it's not the problem that usually gets discussed.
And it's not a problem solved by Do Not Track. I mean,
So how would you solve it?
Well, there are larger issues. Medical records, let's take that as an example, which people are really just kind of ignoring. This is being marched through every state legislature and through the federal Congress.
But I wouldn't disagree with that.
But because everybody's all worried about tracking cookies, which is a very minor privacy infringement, if at all, they're ignoring many larger issues in privacy. I agree we should have the right to privacy. I'm not saying you shouldn't have the right to privacy. I choose to live more in public than most, but I don't think that's something I would choose for anybody else. Your kids certainly deserve the right to privacy and are going to grow up in a world where that's going to be a difficult thing to achieve. So we should have tools to make that easy. The problem is not that. It's that Do Not Track has nothing to do with privacy. It's about targeting ads to you. It's not. Nobody's invading anybody's privacy. Now, I agree. You may not like the fact that you visit a website and then you see a similar ad in the next website, but that has nothing to do with your privacy.
I think that Do Not Track is great if, in the ideal world, it turned out that you would want to turn it on because your ads got better. When it's not on, your ads are crap and they don't relevant. But you realize, if I turn
people
on
don't
this,
even,
this track...
The truth is, people don't even see these ads.
I'm not sure that it would get to that point.
The ads are meaningless. This is a whole broken model that will be your superseded banner, and display ads don't work.
I think
so.
Yeah, I
in
think
the long
right
run,
yeah.
This is a non-issue.
Does Do Not Track hurt you?
Doesn't hurt us personally. So, and I'm glad to say that because I don't want people to think that I have a dog in this fight and that, I'm trying to defend my business model. It doesn't affect us at all.
Hear that, Ozzy?
But there are a lot of free media businesses it affects deeply. But
do you think that there is, to some extent in Silicon Valley, a sort of a culture of lawlessness where many of these companies are using every excuse to really spy on people? I mean, we had this
But why would
scandal
they spy on
I don't think
you?
It's
what
limited
do they care
to Silicon
about
Valley.
You?
I think it's the advertising
they
world in general.
They're not spying on you. Well, I understand what they were spying
what
on
What about
you?
The LinkedIn scandal this week about how they're using these apps to read what we have on our computers?
Well, again, you had to go install the LinkedIn app and decide to share the calendar. The only problem I had with what LinkedIn did is they didn't make it clear what information was going to be sent to their servers.
I mean,
there's a very good reason for that information to be sent to make the app work
better. I find something like LinkedIn very creepy in the sense that they know... I've had several lives and lots of different friends from different worlds, different continents, different industries. And LinkedIn have an uncanny ability to recommend relevant friends to me.
But isn't that a good thing?
No, it's not a good thing.
Why is that? I can't
help you, Andrew.
That's the key there. Because,
bad news.
And I think that's why people get so angry at you sometimes. Is they're like, yes, but I want that. I want them to recognize friends and good associates. That's what LinkedIn is for. So why is that a bad thing?
You joined LinkedIn. If you didn't join LinkedIn, if you didn't join Facebook, if you didn't surf the internet, maybe you would have to worry about this
stuff.
I'm
not on Facebook anymore.
I'm not on LinkedIn anymore, actually. After their breach, I decided I didn't
want to. I would consider LinkedIn to be a kind of a machine. And I don't want a machine almost knowing more about me than I know about myself.
But that can be helpful sometimes. What's the downside to
that? Well, you're a strict utilitarian. You're only looking in terms of...
This is really where the problem lies, Andrew, is you have this atavistic vision of technology as a living, breathing creature that is spying on you, and I don't want the site to behave. It's not. And I think this is actually a cultural divide.
Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's going to be a generational
cultural
divide.
Cultural between
that there are people
well,
who...
Well, I'm in Santa Rosa. It's not that much of a cultural difference.
You've anthropomorphized technology.
Santa Rosa and
Petaluma. I don't mean culture geographically, and it's probably not even demographically.
But I think you guys, if that's true, and I'm not sure if it is, you guys are in a minority. Because
I agree.
Think most people...
Most people do not...
Are in my camp.
Because we're human and we anthropomorphize, and so we've anthropomorphized technology. You even in the language you use, websites following you around, act as if this website is a thing. It isn't.
What is it?
It's a machine. It's a non-thinking machine. It's algorithms. It's code.
But there are human beings behind it who are profiting from it.
Well, there are human beings who are trying to make a business model around free media work, and as we are. And I think the truth is that the subculture that doesn't like this is really anti-ad. Period. We just don't want to see advertising. And
they say that. I've been accused of that, but I'm not.
Do you like movie trailers?
Look at the back of the book. Look at the guy right at the end. Read it out, Leah.
Sir Martin Sorrell?
Sir Martin Sorrell is the head of WPP, which is the largest advertising company in the world. And I met him through Cult of the Amateur. And, you know, this was a book that attacked an advertising-centric economy. Sorrell likes my work because he understands that advertising alone can't support quality media. So I'm not against advertising.
Well, what does support quality media?
You have to start paying for it as well. And I think that's something that...
That's interesting.
I think that's something that touches on...
we're trying to do the opposite because it's been my experience.
But I'm not against what you're doing. I think what you're doing is very credible. It's the TV model.
I would far prefer not to have any ads... And have a direct relationship with our viewers and have them pay for what they want.
Well, why aren't they paying? Maybe we can
because it doesn't work. We tried it. For the first 2 years, we tried it. And it was insufficient.
But you see, you have a clearer... You don't have as intimate a relationship with your users as, say, Facebook does. One of the arguments in the book is that the free model with Facebook and Google doesn't work because the users are turned into products because... They have to be, because the only model is selling advertising. You're not in the business.
Well, that's kind of my position.
But you wanted this service, and this was the agreement,
and now you want to abrogate the agreement and say, well, I want a free, wonderful free service, but I don't want to pay for it with my data.
He doesn't want the service. But if you don't want the service, don't sign up, and then you have to worry about it.
Well, but you're in a slightly different situation where you offer your viewers high-quality content, but you're not in the business of acquiring their data.
No.
And in contrast, say, with Google or Facebook.
I don't want to be in that business, so
right,
I understand the problem
media
with
business,
it. Yeah.
I'm sympathetic to that.
Yeah.
I'm very suspicious of, say, the Facebook model, which is giving everything for free, making it seem as if it's a public utility. Sheryl Sandberg saying it enables everyone to be authentic, or Google presenting itself as a public utility. But the reality is that these are very profitable businesses whose core value is in the acquisition of our data.
Isn't the key, though, just educating people to be aware of that rather than...
Yes. I'm not against that.
Yeah.
So it means simplifying terms of service.
It needs to be an explicit transaction.
And that's why I use Hitchcock's Vertigo as the kind of metaphor in the book, because in Hitchcock's Vertigo, it's the innocent person who gets turned into the sort of the accomplice, the murderer.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and that's what's happening to many of us on the
internet. I'm sorry. I'm going to take a break.
Speaking
We're going to talk some more.
Speaking of
advertising. Hi, Jojo. Wait a minute. Andrew Keynes, I'm going to give you a plug, even though...
It's all wrong.
You don't deserve it. Actually, no. I love Andrew. Actually, it's really important. You are the burr in our saddle. And it's some people are the wind beneath my wings. He's the burr
in
my saddle.
I agree with Andrew on lots of things.
And I think it's important that we think about these things and talk about them. And that's why we love having him on. The book is Digital Vertigo. How to Date. His kids are getting up saying, we're done. No, got another break. Hold on. Stay here. Today's online social revolution is dividing, diminishing, and disorienting us. You know, if you change this to me, how online social revolution is dividing, diminishing, and disorienting me, I'd say fine.
Do you mean him or you?
Yeah, him, not me.
Oh. Me?
Yeah. Andrew Keene.
But it's a very personal narrative.
It's personal. And so us might be going a little far. Some of us.
Just... One of the three of us.
Well, it can.
Him. I love teasing Andrew Keene, and I'm really glad he's here. And we're going to have more in just a bit. But first, a word from Citrix, talking about Go to Assist, which we've talked about for years. I think when I started doing ads for Go to Assist maybe 5 years ago. They are 10 years old, And when we first started talking about it, it was all about remote access, you know, and it's the kind of thing any geek knows, that the worst thing in the world is to be on the phone saying, okay, hit the start menu. Okay, look for under accessories. Okay, I want you to go. That's a pain. You don't want to do that. You know in your heart that if you could get in there and just do it, you'd fix it in seconds instead of having to walk somebody through it. That's why remote support is so great. And GoToAssist just kind of took it to the nth degree, where you can do 8 sessions at the same time. Unattended support, so they don't have to be there. You know, all the tools you need. You could know what operating system, what software is running in the background, what security software, all of that stuff. Now they've taken GoToAssist and they've added a whole other feature. And this is so cool. Without raising the price. In fact, if you're an existing customer, you get this. It's automatic. It's monitoring. Now, see, in this light of our conversation, this all sounds scary. So what you do is you install the crawler on. This is for your client, right? So you're in managed support. You're in IT. You install the crawler. It gives you every bit of hardware, including network-attached devices like printers and network-attached storage, things like that. All the software running. You can set up a dashboard that remotely monitors and lets you know if a problem's about to happen, you're running out of disk space, a hard drive's dying, the network's not responsive, and you can fix it like that, sometimes even with the unattended support. It's really the ultimate in providing managed support. And if you'd like to be in this business or you are in this business, you've got to try it. Free for 30 days. It's GoToAssist.com. Simple cloud-based platform. The beauty of GoToAssist is you'll get the latest updates automatically every time you use it. So do your clients. So do your customers. Our own IT guy, Russell Tammany, we gave it to him, and he's really excited about this because he has, what did we say, 355, 300, something like that, clients, individual companies something that he like supports. That. Three of them. Three people, 355 clients. You need something like this. GoToAssist.com. And right now, GoToAssist is celebrating its 10th anniversary by giving away 10 Android OS Galaxy tablets. Those are those nice ones on Facebook. Yeah, for 10 years. Visit Facebook, like the GoToAssist page, and you're in. That's your chance to win. And I do hope you win because it's a nice tablet. GoToAssist.com. Use the offer code Triangulation to try. And if you want to win one of those tablets, like them on Facebook. GoToAssist on Facebook. You're a business now. You almost have to be on Facebook, don't you?
Well, I almost, my business is not being on Facebook.
Not you personally, but any other business, except General Motors.
Well, I think that's...
There's an example of a company that just...
Well, I think that hopefully people will read the book, and I make two arguments about social media. The first, that it is not, it's a sort of a cultural conservative argument that it's narcissistic and that we were spending our time broadcasting ourselves and that's bad and we've got to pull our socks up and grow up and all that, which I think is part of the argument. But there's a more complex argument in the book as well, that in this shift from an analog industrial mass society where we all worked in firms to a 21st century knowledge economy, guys like us, where we're all self-employed, free agent nation, these are platforms for 21st century life. So actually, your argument about Facebook, well, if you don't want to be on it, don't be on it.
Right.
Don't.
No, there's a lot of...
The reality is that you have to. I mean, yeah, I did a piece for The Atlantic on Glancy and Highlight. To get onto Glancy and Highlight, you've got to be on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's increasingly becoming the front door to the internet. So
that's something I want to fight, by the way. I think that's appalling.
What?
That it is the front door to the internet. That's not what we want.
Right.
We want a free and open internet.
Yeah.
Where you have choices.
Yeah, and I think social media, this knitting together of all these thousands of new socially connected networks, you know, Facebook is becoming almost a default front door, which is why they had that ridiculous valuation.
Yeah, it's not a good thing.
And I think what happens, though, is we find out that those things are unsustainable.
Monoculture is a bad thing anywhere.
And I think the same thing could happen to Facebook that happened to AOL. Everybody thought AOL was going to take over the internet. It was a horrible
thing.
Thank
God it
failed. And the internet was going to, you know, should fight back against AOL's version of the internet. And it turned out that once people realized, hey, wait a minute, there's some disadvantages to this, AOL faltered. It didn't take over the internet. I think that could happen to Facebook as well, where people start to realize, wait a minute, I don't like being locked into this universe.
But it's not only just being locked into the universe, it's being on the network. It's doing your business. It's advertising yourself. So whether you're on Facebook or Google Plus or any of these new social networks, it's increasingly, I've made the argument that...
So is your problem with the social network itself as an idea?
Well, it's this place, you know, 50 billion intelligent devices by 2020. More and more, I mean, maybe in 20 years, everyone's going to be on this network. And we're all going to be doing our business. It is the real global village. And I'm not saying we should dismantle it. I'm not saying we shouldn't be on it. But I am saying that we have no choice. And if we're going to make it, and Leo might have a stroke when I use this word, if we are going to make it human, or at least replicate what we want as human beings, it needs to learn how to forget. I know you don't like that idea.
But it's not that I don't like it. I think it's fine.
Well, we need to try to figure out ways that it can do a better job forgetting than it currently does.
You can't even get forgotten on Facebook. So you withdraw from Facebook, and every single person that ever posted a picture of you, those pictures are all going to live.
The internet never forgets anything unless you wanted to keep it.
You can't. Then it forgets it.
Then you can't find it.
You can't be forgotten in life either. I mean, good luck.
Technology that's being developed in the Netherlands that will enable data to degenerate. I write about it in the book.
Yeah, no, it's a real thing. And it seems like it will work. The thing is, those things are never perfect, so it may work in a lot of cases.
Right, it's
the
issue is that we're intermingled, and you don't control all of the information about you. And so it isn't possible to remove all the information about you because it is entirely entangled with everybody else's information. And the notion that you could remove it is like the notion you could erase your life. You cannot. You have had the impacts. It's too late.
You can do a pretty fair job of it, but it takes a lot of effort.
I don't think it's doable. Try and delete your Facebook account and then go back in 10 years. Yeah, but I guarantee you there's still pictures and information about Andrew Keen all over Facebook. And in fact, they probably could build an equivalent picture of you from other people's contributions to Facebook.
But that doesn't justify timeline or the social graph.
I love timeline. Nobody uses timeline except you. Because it's a narcissistic...
And Facebook.
It's, of course, a great ploy for Facebook's point of view.
Yeah.
But that's an agreement. I think nobody's so unsophisticated as to think that Facebook is giving you this because out of the goodness of their heart.
That's the problem. There are people out there who are that unsophisticated.
Now talk about the naive...
Why would they think that? Do you think that Facebook just loves you and they just gave you timeline because you're so nice?
But what about
you deserve
Google?
It.
I mean, people think that Google's a public service.
They do have that utility. It was actually very clever of them
to
have the very clean front page because it effectively looked like a utility. It didn't look like they were trying to make any money off of you. So that was probably a conscious.
I think people trust Google more than they trust Facebook.
I do. Certainly.
I think that
Google
trust is eroded.
Has its own problems.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what do you tell your kids? I mean, this is a question I have all the time about my own children. Is what do you tell your kids? We're dying off. We're the dinosaurs. They're the future.
Singularity's in here.
Maybe not. You know, that would be the worst thing that could happen to kids is that we don't die. You better pray, kids, that we're gone because you don't want us to hang around.
Using up resources.
Do you tell them? Are they on Facebook?
Kids are both at. I shouldn't be talking about this.
Don't say where they are.
But they're in
a school where they're not allowed to participate in life.
They're not allowed to watch TV. When they have friends over, they're not allowed to watch movies, which pisses me off because I think that...
Do you think that's a sensible...
No, I don't think that's sensible.
And they don't. They're going, no. No, that's a very... By the way, Waldorf's an interesting theory. It's a very extreme theory.
But I think... I don't like to turn this into a generational debate because then I'm really on thin ice because I get classified fairly probably as the old guy complaining about how badly behaved young people are. I think it goes
beyond the generational issue. Yeah, I do too.
I mean, there was an interesting piece on CNN from a couple of psychologists which showed that kids are growing up thinking that there's no private life because their parents are posting these photos of themselves all over. I think, you know, one of the things that really I didn't like about Facebook is I used to go on and find people who I actually liked and respected posting all these intimate details, photos of their infants.
Yeah,
but what happens is we change what shocks us.
Exactly.
So
it's
there
a cultural
are things that
shift.
We thought this should be private. I think
we used to think it wasn't okay to come out as homosexual.
Isn't that big of a deal? But I think we're also learning there are things that should still be private. I think we're redefining.
I think we have to be very careful relativizing it by saying, well, every generation has norms, and so nothing's absolute.
You disagree.
I mean, my book argues that there is something absolute, which is the inner world, the inner life of the self.
I think that's interesting. And that needs to happen in private, you think?
Well, I think it needs to take, much of it needs to take place in terms of the formation of personality, a sense of identity, needs to take place off the network.
Offline.
That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be on networks, but it does mean that kids who, or grown-ups who live completely in public, who broadcast themselves endlessly, I think are shallower. And I think weak individuals create a weak society.
Is that correlation or causation, though?
Well, it's both.
Because not everybody broadcasts everything.
No, it's true. And, you know, there's only, as we've said, there's only a few Scobles in the world. But the world is shifting. The world is getting a lot closer to Scoble than it is, say, towards me, and I'm a fairly private person.
I think that's an interesting premise, though, that there is a crucible of the personality that has to at some point incur in offline, in private. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't think necessarily as you aptly pointed out, I live in public, except, of course, I don't.
You don't, really. You're
Nobody
closer to
does.
Me than being like Scoble, I think. I don't know much about you.
Oh, you don't search the internet much.
The question is,
Scoble's very noisy about his sharing.
How much room do you need for that crucible, right? How much privacy?
That's right.
I think that's really where
you don't need 100%.
No, you don't need 100%. That's a calibration issue, but you need more than 1%.
Yeah.
And at the moment, the scales are shifting dramatically towards the public.
But that's a personal choice. You don't have to do that.
Well, everything's a personal choice.
This might be an argument.
I don't like that argument.
Why not?
Because I'm not sure if people are always smart or responsible enough to know what's best for them. And that sometimes...
Do you think they could be, though?
Well, I think if we create a culture, a default culture of publicness, where people just grow up with the assumption that they should tell the world everything about themselves, the vast majority of people will just do that. And I don't think that's for the benefit of us as a species or for us as individuals. I don't think it makes us happier. I don't think it adds to a more meaningful or richer life.
I think
my argument is that the internet is a new tool that none of us know exactly how to use yet. We're learning it all the time.
I agree.
And we'll figure that out.
But I think it's also
appropriate
to be cautionary.
But that's
too.
A libertarian. You say, well, it's a new thing. We don't know what it's. So let's just
let it go.
And I think
I'm not saying stand back. Actually, I'm saying we need to dive in and figure it out.
Yeah, I think the cautionary note is highly appropriate.
But don't you think it's fair that when I wrote my first book, as you know, Leo, it got absolutely trashed by everyone. Probably in some ways fairly.
Don't say that. Not so. I think.
Well, but it was a defense of anyway. But this book has had a completely different response. I mean, I did a speech in Belgrade 3 weeks ago to hardcore internet activists, and in my first book, I'd have made a similar speech. I would have been booed off stage. I would have been attacked. But they loved it. Mm-hmm. I think there's a shift culturally.
I agree.
I think there's more and
there's
more suspicion
hunger.
Of large media companies.
Yep.
Google has lost its sheen.
I agree.
Facebook is very unpopular with most people. And I think that the cult, you've seen more and more, Eli Parisa's book, Nick Carr's book, Sherry Turk. We all started as believers in this thing. I mean, eventually, Leo, you're going to write a book like
Jaron Lanier.
Yeah.
You are not a gadget.
Yeah.
There aren't many of you left who believe in it.
Well, I
the
believe.
Thing, the thing about Jaron that I find interesting is, and like you have said today, is none of this stuff is bad. We just need to notice that there are bad things about it and avoid
No,
those
he
things.
Thinks it's bad.
Who, Jaron?
You.
No. Oh, no, Andrew.
You know, there is one area, and you probably touched on this in The Cult of the Amateur, where I kind of worry about artists who in the past have been able to learn their art and create privately until they reached a certain maturity and then went public. And now everybody's posting every video from day one, and we're all growing as artists in public. And I wonder.
That's interesting.
I wonder what the consequence of that is. I mean, I think that's very different.
Well, I think in a positive way, I think the creative artists are going to be much more intimate with their audience.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think one of the great achievements of the internet is to break down this artificial boundary between the artist and the audience.
I
love the fact that I can go on Twitter and I get all my readers and they say and they criticize, they like it. It gives me real immediate access, which is fantastic.
It's been a revelation to us.
But I'm not a sort of a Jay Rosen type who thinks that after a while the internet does away with the distinction between artist and audience. Because I think there is always going to be There are always going to be artists who are able to create interesting works, and there are always going to be audiences whose main business is in the consumption of those works. And I don't think that this sort of confusion or conflation of the two is good for either artists or audience.
No, I don't think it's an artist and an audience if you do away with the distinction. It's
Leo's thinking about that one.
Yeah, I have to think about that. Because I am fundamentally for the democratization
of creativity. Yeah, but you're an
creativity.
Artist. No, yeah,
and I don't think I should.
Leo Laporte.
But why should I say, well, you can't?
No,
see, remember, part
that.
Of my bias comes
I'm
from the fact...
I'm not saying that. I'm saying you can't. I'm just making the observation that there's only one Leo Laporte.
Yeah, and there's only one everybody, right? Everybody has a unique point of view.
But how many people could have achieved this? Yeah. You've built up a remarkable business, a self-brought... You're the only guy in the world...
Everybody should have the opportunity to
do
that.
But no one said... I never said otherwise. I'm simply stating a fact.
Ah, but...
But there were people who believed that everyone could do it.
I have to point out. No. And so there is a difference. And I understand now where the confusion comes from. Because in the past, it didn't even matter if you could do it, because there was a concentration of capital that was required to do this. And so the fundamentally democratizing force of the internet and digital technology means that there are many more who have the ability and the wherewithal, but lacked the capital, lacked the ability to do it, because for purely financial reasons, that who can now do it. And, you know, I have to say, there's things on the on YouTube like Annoying Orange, which your kids probably adore, but which I find completely reprehensible.
Do you know Annoying Orange?
Oh, yeah. They know Annoying Orange.
That's okay.
They're too old for it now. But when they were 8 or 9, it was the funniest thing ever, right? And that would not have existed in the past, because the gatekeepers were all adults. And there is no gatekeeper anymore. And so I think what's happening is that you're seeing media created for people who were both as consumers and creators disenfranchised. And I'm not saying everybody has to be an artist. I disagree with, if that's what Jay's saying, I disagree. But I do think that the opportunity, everybody should have that opportunity. The gatekeepers are gone, and that is a very positive, beneficial effect. And you're right, some people have voices who say horrendous things. But that's a side effect.
And some people just won't be very good.
And some people won't be very good, but I don't think that's necessarily
that's okay.
A bad thing. Anyway, we're out of time. But, Andrew, I love we need this voice. I think we need somebody to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. Because I, and I think many like me, are just kind of inexorably on the march towards the future. And maybe somebody should just stand up and say, is this really where you want? I think of those young boys in World War One who just marched off saying, well, we'll be back. We'll be back soon. Mm. And somebody should have stood up and said, hey, wait a minute. Maybe this isn't such a good idea. The book, if it is actually I really like this.
Thank you. It is really good.
And even if you read Cult of the Amateur and were infuriated by it, you may still be infuriated. But I don't think you can disagree with the broad range and depth of the discussion and the arguments. And it's really enjoyable to read. Is it on audiobook?
It's Audible. Me, and I read it.
Oh, great.
Awesome. So you have my wonderful voice.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Andrew Keen, ajkeen.com. The book is called Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. Did you write the subtitle, or did your publisher do that?
My publisher.
Yeah, see, that's they're trying. See, they're dividing us. They're trying to divide us.
But Digital Vertigo was my idea.
I love that.
Disorient.
And I think that's accurate.
And the cover is beautiful. I think if there's an argument in favor of the
hashtag,
physical book...
But it's funny, isn't it?
I think
it's hysterical. It's really good. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate your time.
And we will have you back. I'd love to, you know, we were talking before the show about maybe having you be our anti-editor, the guy who comes in and says, hey, knock it off.
The danger, though, of that is that after a while we're going to start to agree.
I know we are. But who's going to move more in whose direction is the only question. Hey, it's brain food. That's what they said this show is. Houston just said, this is brain food. This is your daily or weekly dose of brain food. Tom Merritt is back tomorrow with TNT Tech News Today, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC, every Monday through Friday for your daily dose of tech news. I'll be back tomorrow with Windows Weekly and iPad Today. And
about the Windows stuff today.
And Before You Buy. Yeah, there's a lot of Windows news. Do join us each and every week, though, for this show. We do it on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Pacific. We always have really good people. Do we know who's next week?
Jeremy Bentham.
He's just going to stand there quietly, and we'll throw things at him. Actually, Rob Reed, our guest last week. Pardon me?
Jeremy from Kaggle.
Oh, good. That'll be fun.
I met him last night.
Yeah.
Our guest last week, Rob Reeds, got a teaser up for his new book.
For Year Zero?
Yeah.
Excellent.
So read Rob Reed, readrobreid.com if you want to see the new teaser. Apparently it's really good. I haven't seen it yet. He just sent me an email. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.